This is Mark Strassman, a reporter with Utopia Media's Entertainment Technology World. We're about to speak to Ken Lowe, who's VP for Strategic Marketing at Sigma Designs, based in Milpitas, California. Welcome to Utopia Media's Entertainment Technology World.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about digital media processing and how your company helps people do it. What is digital media processing as a process?
Essentially, digital media processing is the the consumer equipment correlation to the central processor in a PC. So just as the central processor in a PC runs all the software and essentially establishes the processes by which the PC programs are executed, so does the media processor for digital media consumer products.
And so it's essentially doing the work of decoding the code in
incoming streams. So basically, we have a myriad of different consumer products, digital media consumer products, anything from DVD players to digital TV set-top boxes. There are new digital media receivers coming on. Each of these pieces of equipment receives streams coming in, audio-video streams that are digitally encoded.
Right.
And those streams need to have the streams need to be first depacketized because they come in packets. Then that packet information stripped off. Any sort of encryption needs to be unlocked so the content's available for you. And then that content gets decoded into the audio stream gets decoded, the video stream gets decoded, and then later on they get synchronized together, and then they get put out to a television or other display device.
Okay, now it's obviously important what the standards are that a particular digital media processor will support. What's the story on that? Which formats do your products support? What's the politics of this right now? What formats are vying for superiority? And is your policy to essentially be able to encode all comers and decode them? Or how's that working?
Well, it's a very good question. You know, I think the current battle is waging on between H.264 and Windows Media 9, and the backdrop to that is that we've existed for 10 years or so predominantly putting out consumer equipment using MPEG-2 as the dominant video decoder standard.
Right.
And that serviced the DVD industry, most of the digital TV, including ATSC broadcast in the U.S., is based on that standard. Now what we've done is we've entered a new era where there are two driving forces that are pushing us to use higher compression codecs, one of which is the ability to squeeze more digital media onto wired and wireless pipes that weren't originally designed to take it. So we need to squeeze more data into those pipes. The second is to be able to deliver high definition.
Right.
And in many cases, deliver high definition in the same or similar space that standard definition used to take.
So essentially those are really both compression issues. How you can get something at all through a wireless or other restricted platform, and how you can get more information on any platform or any display unit that you're going to use.
Exactly.
So these are all really compression issues.
Essentially they are compression issues, and as the compression standard changes, several things are affected, one of which is that you have to then, content has to move over and start supporting the new compression standard.
Right.
You have to have methods of supporting the legacy of content that's out there.
Right.
You want to be able, as you're moving forward, what you recognize is that there are two competing standards at this point for the next generation advanced codec, which is again Microsoft Windows Media 9 or VC1 as the SMPTE group is going to be calling their standard. And then H.264, also called AVC, Advanced Video Codec. Now these two are relatively competitive with each other, relatively similar in terms of their compression abilities, obviously offered from different groups. But from an equipment maker standpoint, the ideal situation is not to have to choose which one you deploy in customer premise equipment.
Right.
You'd like to be able to support both. If you're making a digital TV or a DVD player or a set-top box, the ideal situation is to be able to support both.
This issue keeps coming up. This goes back to VHS versus Betamax. And right now I think the DVD people are fighting over Blu-ray versus its competitor.
Exactly. So the HD DVD standard, which is being pursued by the DVD forum, and then the Blu-ray group, which is creating their own Blu-ray standard, are trying to create again. That's a very close parallel to the VHS versus Betamax war. But in the case of the codecs, the compression decompression codecs, both of those groups have adopted all of the codecs we're talking about. So each one of those two standards have already designated that the DVD players of the future for high definition need to support Windows Media 9, H.264, and MPEG-2.
All three standards.
All three must be in there, and all three must be at high definition.
So you're saying
these are high definition capable players.
So you're saying whoever wins this DVD competition or leads in it, all the high definition DVD players are going to need to support all three of these codecs.
They will, and essentially the gain for the consumer there is that they will have a relatively universal solution. They'll be set up quite nicely with the equipment they'll be able to buy. The downside is this equipment will be more costly. The media processor component, which we deal in, will be about 10 times more complex than the predecessor was.
Right.
So this will necessitate a higher level of sophistication both in the componentry and the software that manages it.
So from your point of view, there's a solution that you a path that you can pursue of essentially being universally useful for all of these codecs, and that sort of solves your problem, and then people can use your chips that implement those multiple platform solutions.
That's right. I mean, the course that we have gone on is we have been an innovator in supporting advanced codecs because we've dealt in several different types of products that really get sold to the enthusiast.
Right.
Enthusiasts love to embrace new technologies.
Right.
So the bottom line there is that we were the first to introduce MPEG-4 support in a mainstream chip that could be used in consumer equipment. We were the first to introduce Windows Media 9 in a commercially viable chip that could be used in consumer equipment. And we are shortly going to be introducing our new chip that will be supporting H.264. We intend on launching that at the CES show in January.
Right.
And that will be a chip that then supports all codecs and high definition.
So you're pretty much agnostic then in the competition among these different competing groups.
Well, we become twofold. We become agnostic to which codec is used.
Right.
But we become an advocate of using media processors that support a universal solution.
Right.
So that's a win-win. It's a win for a telco that's deploying a new IP video service across their DSL lines because they can put out customer premise equipment that can support any one of the standards. It's a win for the consumer because they're set up with something if they buy over the shelf that will run for any content that comes across.
And that means independent content providers can provide that content in any of the three codecs.
Yes.
So if I want to set up my Utopia Media IPTV station, I can encode my material in any of those standards.
That's exactly right.
And it'll be playable when it finally gets to the end user.
Right. So so by going that route, they have imposed a little bit greater burden on the set-top box, on the DVD player, on the TV to support these different standards. But at the same time, again, I think the user benefits because he gets a wider array of choices. He doesn't have to worry about which one works on the box.
Right.
The studios that are going to encode their own content, they get to choose which format gives them, in their opinion, the best quality, the best return on their investment.
Right.
And again, the service providers, again, get to make sure that there's some obsolescence proofing in their equipment just in case something were to happen to one of these standards and momentum heads toward another one,
right.
They're covered.
Now, is it likely or possible that a new contender would come up to complicate the mix even further?
Well, based on the fact that it really took, 8 to 10 years for something to come along that was substantially superior to MPEG-2,
right,
in order to unseat all the momentum of the incumbent that has all this content behind it,
right,
I would imagine that it's going to be another 8 to 10 years before we could possibly envision making another leap at that level.
Okay, now how backwardly compatible to run legacy material is this solution?
Well, I think all the types of products we're talking about will support the legacy content. You know, I think that's one of the the big contentions of the war between the HD DVD and the Blu-ray standards. HD DVD standard is looking very intently on making sure there's backwards compatibility. I think that's a key focal area of theirs, and I think the Blu-ray group is, and I think they both face certain challenges in doing that. Current DVDs are recorded using a red laser.
Right.
And all these new products are based on a blue laser.
Right.
So the physical media readability is in jeopardy when it comes to a player like that, but the actual content streams, if they're streamed in, if they're downloaded, if you can get the media to play them, they will have backwards compatibility because the electronics inside these boxes will support the decoding of those streams.
Okay. I think we've... anything more before we sort of move outward about these compatibility standards and Sigma Design's role in doing that? Do you work closely with these groups to make sure that you've got the silicon ready when they've reached their agreement on their... standards?
We do. We work closely with the standards groups to make sure that we're adhering to the direction they're heading and influence where possible. We work with the telcos to make sure that we stay abreast of their needs and be able to provide IPTV solutions. And we work with consumer equipment vendors to make sure that the trends in networking and other types of home factors are accommodated.
Do you ever tell the codec developers that there's a certain way they might want to go, that the silicon would work better in that direction? Or do they tell? They say what they want to do, and you figure out how to implement it in the hardware.
Well, I think there is a level of dialogue that takes place, and I think that's the purpose of these standardization committees, really, is to strike the correct balance between what's ideal from an algorithmic or software standpoint and what is practical from a hardware standpoint.
Right. So they'll say we'd like to do this and that, and you can tell them, well, it'll take this many more MIPS to do it that way.
Precisely.
It'd be better to do it the other way. So you're pretty much at the sort of crux, turning point, center balancing point there among all these different players in the industry, aren't you?
That's right.
Okay. Let's talk about what all this can do and how it's going to be implemented. What's the difference between a set-top box, or is convergence going to make sort of these questions irrelevant pretty soon? What's the difference between a set-top box and a personal digital media recorder or a streaming decoder? Are these all converging sort of to one big... one small box powered by some of your chips?
Well, there is a tremendous amount of convergence going on. And I guess one way to conceptually look at this is to separate the various different functions. And since about 75% of all the functionality is really done in the media processor,
right,
and that same media processor now is being thrust into a role where it has to support all the different standards. It has to support high definition. It has to have an integrated CPU that manages all the software.
Right.
It has to be able to perform the decryption that unlocks the keys to the content for the DRM-protected content.
Right.
And it has to prepare the resultant decoded streams for display on the television. You really are ending up in a situation where the commonality between most types of digital media consumer equipment is 80%. 80% of the value add inside the box is the same. The only thing that's different is the front end. On a DVD player, you have a DVD drive and an interface component to talk to it. On a network, whether it's wired or wireless, you have an interface device that connects you to that network. Likewise, for a set-top box, you would have either a tuner, if it's a broadcast receiver, or you would have a certain type of network chip or DSL interface.
So in fact, what we're going to here really is whether it's on your cell phone, your laptop, your PDA, your television set, your home entertainment center, your stadium screen, or your whatever beyond that's going to be created, it's really the same thing happening with different output devices, or it's different size screens, isn't it?
Yes, essentially, yes. At the very core of the functionality, it's all merging into the way you manage and manipulate the information and then turn it into displayable or audible information is all the same.
Now, there's also the convergence with voice over IP here, isn't there?
Yeah, well, that's one of the other functions that is being integrated in to a good number of consumer offerings.
Because it really doesn't matter at the hardware level whether you're listening to dialogue in a movie or whether you're listening to the person you're talking to on the cell phone or the voice phone or the video phone that's interacting with you, is it?
That's right. And I think one of the advantages there is that, as with any IP-type mechanism, you basically can operate with time slices, you know, as opposed to a dedicated channel you open up and dedicate to voice communication or any other function.
Circuit packet switching versus circuit switching.
Exactly.
So that means essentially you can do things like have you could have a movie, and if you did it properly, you could have people all around the world voicing the dialogue, and you could integrate that in this with this chip as well.
That's exactly correct, yes.
Okay. What are the timetables that we're talking about, both in Europe, Asia, and the United States, for the rollout of some of these convergent products?
Well, I think Asia has been the most aggressive. I think they have shown not only a high degree of interest, but they've also got a situation that's been most conducive. They don't have dominant cable infrastructure. They do have the need. They do have a high bandwidth DSL network in many of the countries. So I think this is something that's been benefiting their adoption.
We're talking about Korea in particular here. They seem to be very aggressive in the rollout of broadband and the whole transformation of their culture through electronics.
They really have. They've been very aggressively pursuing the widespread availability of broadband capability, and they've applied that to the internet. They're applying that to video delivery mechanisms. Japan is also showing an equal aggressiveness in you know, their examination and rollout of certain services. Several other countries are looking at similar things. Europe, again, similar situation where cable is not dominant. There's only one or two countries where cable is a factor. Same situation exists. The telcos are the powerful arm of the telecommunications industry, and they have a vested interest in offering video services where they can create additional revenue streams.
So this is essentially why DSL is the dominant broadband technology in the world now, although in the United States it's most often broadband is most often delivered over cable.
Over cable in general. It's the cable infrastructure in the U.S. is what makes the U.S. a unique market.
Okay.
And what makes the dynamic different. But as we're seeing from the announcement with SBC and Microsoft of a couple weeks ago, I think the trend in the North America market is just about to change.
Which means that we can I want to get to wireless in a second, but the trade-off or the balance between cable and DSL, you're saying, is likely to be moving more towards DSL in North America due to such things as SBC's deal with Microsoft to provide IPTV over DSL.
Right. I think the key thing here is that you know, everybody wants to get increasing amounts of bandwidth in
right.
the home.
Right.
And to be able to deploy that bandwidth for a myriad of uses. So essentially you're offering a customer a range of bandwidth related services, and the wider your bandwidth, the wider your range of services.
And in fact, what we were just talking about the essential agnosticism of the system, given your chips and these protocols, the drive then is on for greater bandwidth, and it doesn't really matter how it's delivered because all the services can be delivered over that broader bandwidth.
That's right. Exactly right.
Okay. So that means, in practice, that people will be getting more of their video from the phone company and less of it from the cable companies.
Okay.
Is that about right?
Yes. I mean, that's a key part of it, yes.
Then does wireless play a role in this, or is it just one more way of delivering bandwidth, and you're happy to put your chips in their boxes at the end users regardless of how the bandwidth is being delivered, and in fact, you then become a big support, as you were saying earlier, agnostic as to the protocols, but a big booster as to more bandwidth.
Yes, we are. We are agnostic to the type of connection that goes into the box. We support wired, wireless, all forms of connections. And to your former question, I think the main difference between wired and wireless is that typically almost all solutions at this point get into the home on a wired basis.
Right.
And within the home, the key trend is to go wireless within the home.
Right.
To be able to use either 802.11g or ultra-wideband or other technologies to create a home entertainment network that's capable of carrying both video and audio.
Right. And when you say both video and audio, that includes voice over IP and therefore the basic telephony services.
Right.
Okay. What are the challenges that are remaining on a technical level for you to do? Are we now in essentially a post-breakthrough refinement period and you're going to be sort of fine-tuning this, or are you working on any sort of major breakthroughs that would move all this to another level, or is the issue now to sort of make this level work?
I think, with this new product that we'll be introducing at CES, we'll be at a point where we'll be able to offer the kind of solution that I think many, many people in the industry have been looking for.
What's the name of this product?
We haven't really announced the name.
Okay.
But we've indicated that the features of this next generation solution.
Tell us what they are and the genre it's in and the features of it.
Well, the key features are, again, moving over to a chip that within one single chip can offer high definition support for H.264, Windows Media 9 and MPEG 2, all in one chip.
Okay.
It also offers security support for digital rights management security.
Right.
And various other refinements to the to the different support subsystems.
Okay. Now, where are you going to release this, and when?
It's going to be launched at the CES show in January, and so that's where it'll be demonstrated for the first time.
Okay. And then what are the types of companies that are going to want to buy it, and what are they going to put it in?
The companies that are going to buy it are going to be, it's being looked at heavily by people doing IPTV set-top boxes.
Right.
Being looked at by people doing digital media receivers. Being looked at by people doing HD DVD players.
Okay. So that's essentially the whole universe of this particular convergence.
It is a big portion of the universe that consumes these types of chips.
Do you have much? Does Sigma Designs, say a little bit about Sigma Designs as a company? Is it publicly traded, privately held?
Sigma's a public company. We've been around for about 20 years. In the last 4 to 5 years, we've been focused on digital media processors as semiconductor components. Prior to that, we were much more heavily involved in the PC market. But we have been servicing several high-growth consumer sectors for the last several years. We have been the leading solution for IPTV deployments. We have sold into such things as SoftBank in Japan, which is Yahoo Broadband.
Right.
Other types of telcos. We have been a leading supplier for digital media receivers, wireless boxes used within the home to create the network. We have been a leading force in the multi-format advanced DVD players that support MPEG-4 and DivX, provide networking support, etc. And now recently, new boxes have been introduced, new DVD players have been introduced that support Windows Media Video as well. And we also have participated in, at this point in time, we've launched some designs on high-definition TV and portable media devices.
What's your stock trading at these days?
Our stock trades at about just over $9 at this point in time, and I think we're traded on the NASDAQ market under the symbol SIGM.
SIGM. I know it's forward-looking and so on, but it sounds like the prospects look pretty good for the company at this point, as long as people keep demanding more broadband and more programming.
The company feels very good about the prospects for its futures, about the amount of interest being shown for its current and future chips, and the company's ability to deliver the kind of solution that the market trends are driving toward.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for explaining some of the technology and some of the trends and how they work to our listeners. And hopefully, as this process rolls out, we'll be able to talk to you some more and see how it's proceeding.
That sounds good. I look forward to it.
All right. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks.
Bye.